Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. I'm your host, Mike Consul. In the spotlight during this episode is Amy Sands Brodoff. She is the author of several novels and short story collections, but her latest work is called The Sleep of Apples. It is a novel, but it is also a collection of linked short stories, which is very interesting to me. That's one of the subjects we'll be getting into, along with some of the characterizations that she has in the book, some of the topics that she tackles, some very modern day topics, some modern day characters. So with that, Amy Sands Brodoff, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Mike. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And let me start by asking you a really fundamental question. Why do you write?
Well, Mike, I write to make sense of the world and to create a shape where there seems to be just chaos or pain or meaninglessness. And I actually find it comforting that writing is a practice that I've been involved in pretty much since childhood. And for me, there's something redeeming about writing and making a connection with readers, hoping, you know, to produce empathy, entertaining, moving, changing, enlightening. So it's this really fulfilling act of, it's almost sculptural, like taking like things that happen or fears or obsessions and creating something that has a shape, like a sculpture has a shape.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned a sculpture, because I was just talking recently on one of the podcasts about sculpting and additive versus subtractive sculpting and so on. I think writing very much is like sculpture, particularly since we tend to produce a lot of copy and then we chisel away at that to distill it down to its essence, as well as rewriting it and so on. So now you mentioned childhood. At what age did you know that you wanted to pursue a writing career or just plain write?
Well, I won't talk about a career first, but I think as soon as I discovered the joy of reading, I remember being in kindergarten or first grade, and the way we learned to read was this sort of giant red book that the teacher held up, and we sat in a little circle. So I was really passionate about reading as a child, and I knew I wanted to write from around 5 years old. I mean, I wouldn't say that in terms of a career, but I loved writing. I used to take long walks with my older brother, Andy. We had this huge golf course behind our house, and we told stories out loud to each other, so that's kind of how it started, sort of oral storytelling, I guess, with my brother.
That's interesting. So you're telling stories to each other. Did you go back and forth and build on one another's story? So he might say a line and then you would deliver a line that builds on what he said, or were you telling independent stories?
I think we built on the same story together. It's kind of communal. Although as a novelist and writer now, it's very much my own thing. Like, I don't really collaborate except at the stage of, you know, working with an editor, which we could talk about later. But with my brother, it was sort of just a fun thing that we did together.
You know, that's interesting, because Steven Spielberg, the great movie director, I remember reading a magazine about him in one of the big news magazines, Time or Newsweek, and he sits around the dinner table with the children and his wife. And those children, some of them are biological. I believe he also has some adopted children. And one of the routines that we'll do is he will come up with a line, basically the start of a story, and then it's handed off to the person next to him to add a line to. And of course, some of these are younger children, unbridled in their imagination, which makes them
That's
all
cool,
the more.
Yeah,
it makes them all the more valuable, because what happens to us as we become adults is we're always so concerned about sounding foolish that we really tend to restrain ourselves in a way that doesn't lend itself as much to the creative imagination of, say, a child. You mentioned that you make sense of the world through writing. I want to ask you to expand on that just a little bit, or maybe get into other facets of writing? Because one of the questions I want to ask is, what does writing do for you? It makes sense of the world. Are there some other aspects, other things it does for you?
Well, it does a lot. I mean, I really think of my writing more as a calling and a practice rather than a career. It is my career, but like any practice, it provides a kind of structure and purpose and meaning to my life. And the idea that it's a practice is really important. Like, you don't pick it up like every 6 weeks. So it's a purpose, it's a goal, it's a dream. I would say that writing gives me a lot of joy, the process of finding the story, which goes back to that image, which I think is great, of sculpting, because that really fits my practice. There are writers, though, who have to kind of, well, I have to do both. I have to carve away, but I also have to develop, and we could talk about that more later, because things don't sort of spring fully born on the page. Sometimes you have to really develop and think about elements in order to create the depth that a really good novel or story will have. So it does give me joy. Even when it's very difficult. And I still have this memory when I lived more near New York. I used to write in this library, and I was so frustrated with the story that I was working on. It wasn't working at all. And then I just took a walk. I actually got a migraine from being so frustrated. And then I took a walk in the park, and literally I just had this epiphany of how to make this story work. And that's the joy. That's what writing gives me, just that you can find your story is very exciting.
Now let's get back to sculpting, because I had mentioned, there's additive and there's subtractive sculpting. I mean, just as a simple explanation, I can see a block of stone and you chisel away at it. Let's make that block of stone the equivalent of having produced a lot of copy, all aimed at that particular subject or character, what have you. Now you take the chisel to it and you slowly, basically, pare away. The copy that doesn't really make the cut. Then there's additive, where you start with some core idea or some core sentence or paragraph, and it's a concept or it's a notion. And then there is, just like with a clay sculpture, where you may be adding more clay to it to help develop it and build it out. How much of your writing is subtractive versus additive in terms of, going back to that? The sculpting analogy. Do you tend to feel like it's all additive, or do you feel all subtractive, or what kind of ratio might exist between the two if you're doing both?
Well, I think the clay analogy is the closest to my writing practice. I'm definitely a putter inner, and I write very freely at first because that's sort of important to, getting in touch with the unconscious and having things happen that you might not expect, going back to the kind of freedom of childhood. So I definitely carve away, but I find with to get the real layers in and the depth, as I said, it doesn't spring fully born on the page. Like, for example, let's take developing characters. So, characters are so important. Like, what makes me love a book is that I'm not that I necessarily like or love the characters. I might love some of them, but they're interesting. I'm just drawn in. So, some of the time, I'll have a character. It might be based on an experience of someone I know or a composite or imagination. But I'll find as I'm writing that it's not fully developed even in my own mind of who this character is, which is a big problem because if it's not clear to me, it's certainly not going to be compelling for the reader. So I'll really take time out and do a kind of deep imagining and note-taking, like what do they have in their refrigerator? What do they have in their closet? What are their fears? What do they like about themselves? What would they love to change? and a whole bunch of things. And I won't use that material in the book, but I'll come out of that exercise, you know, feeling I really know the character. So I definitely do the additive element a lot as well. And that is to get the layers and the depth that really makes a good book. Like sometimes it'll be about plot, like you'll have something happen, but it's not credible. So how do you make it credible? You have to really think about it. And that's additive too. So it's pretty equal. I mean, cutting is very easy for me because I find that I always put stuff aside for a little while, and then when I pick it up again and look at it, it's almost like there's highlighter on the stuff that I have to get rid of. It's very clear. Adding in is harder. You know, you might find it's about landscape or place that you don't really know it well enough, or you're not giving enough of a physicality to the reader of where this place is. You might have to do some research. So I would say it's pretty equal, and I find the distilling easier, and then the other side, the additive side, is the development. And a lot of that comes with many, many, many drafts.
Interesting. So I agree with you completely. Interesting characters are what I'm about. That's what I look for in writing. And I'm reminded of when I first got together with my wife, she said, "Wow, you have a lot of strange friends." And I said, I don't consider them strange. I consider them eccentric. They have idiosyncrasies. They have these various tics, and that's what makes them interesting. And yeah, they have their flights of fancy and whatnot, but it's all what makes them interesting. And certainly when I read, I look for that. And you know, I also work with a woman who said one day, we were exchanging some of the books that we've been reading, and she talked about how it's so much more interesting to read about dysfunctional characters, dysfunctional situations. Oh, yeah. And families and characters, because when they're not dysfunctional, when there's nothing real, then there's nothing really going on there. Then they're just normal people going about their day, and there's nothing to really contemplate. There's nothing that really gives you a different perspective on. And she's a very normal woman. I would say she's a very normal woman, you know, married with children, does a great job, and has a certainly what you would consider to be an everyday personality. So I agree completely. You know, I want to go back to what you said earlier. 5 years old, you decided that writing is something that you wanted to do. That's really early in life. And I think you had used the word calling before. So it sounds like at a very tender age, you just felt the impulse that this spoke to you. And can you elaborate on that at all? Is there, at five, you probably didn't, you know, put a whole lot of thought to it, but beyond just this desire. But is there something more you could say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel very lucky that I always knew what I wanted to do and it didn't change. And nobody, you know, my parents were both doctors and they wanted me at first to be a doctor, then a lawyer, then, okay, well, you know, lawyers write, or a librarian, and I've got a really strong part of my personality, and I knew this is what I wanted to do. And it goes back to the first question you asked, Mike, why do you write? I mean, I find it so comforting. I also really enjoy solitude. I mean, I have a rich family life. I'm married and I have two children, I have a dog. But I really like, I'm kind of an introvert extrovert, I guess. But I really need that time to kind of go inward and to my inner life, which feels like a rich place, and writing really provides that. And
isn't that the truth? The inner life, that inner life. That's what writing is very much about. Is there's this inner life that we live with and we develop in addition to the exterior life.
Definitely, and you need to be. You have to like being alone, and you have to like, you know, it's very delicate that inner life, like, you know, when you have a dream and you sort of like half awake and half asleep, and you sort of remember it, and then you completely forget it when you wake up. And writing, you have that inner life, but if you don't have the solitude and the time to practice your writing, it's like a thread. Like, the more that you sit down and do it, you're going to get more and more inspiration. But if you just ignore it and run away from it, it's just going to die, you know, like a flower without water. So you have to really like solitude. So I really enjoy solitude, but I also love to be with people. But I find if I'm too much always with people and, you know, talking, I just find it really wearing after a while, and I really need that quiet time. And I think that writing is not only when you're sitting at your desk, like working on your project. Like, I do a lot of thinking about what I'm working on at other times, where I'm more relaxed perhaps than when I'm at my desk. And those are also solitary times, because I really like to bike and swim and to walk, and I do a lot of thinking at those times.
Talk about your subject matter. What is your subject matter? Now, you've written several books, so I don't know if there's a consistent theme to subject matter, but artist tends to have a certain, there might be an impressionist, they might be an abstract artist or what have you. Can you put your subject matter into a particular phylum?
Yeah, I think all the books are different, but there's certain themes, I guess, that are kind of obsessions. I write a lot about mental health, mental illness, which is an issue close to my heart. I write often about family, the complexities of family, not only families that you're born into, but the families you form. I tend to write about sort of difficult subjects and subjects that have some weight to them. My last novel dealt with a refugee crisis. And, you know, as a Jewish person, a lot of my family were refugees. I wasn't writing about my Jewish family, but having that history sort of was helpful. And so it varies, but I would say that that's some of the common elements. In this current book, The Sleep of Apples, I deal with mental health, mental illness, and also with mortality. You know, we're still in, and we're going through this COVID pandemic, and I think impermanence and mortality is on everyone's radar. And before the pandemic, I lost my mother, my father, and my beloved stepmom. I don't like the term stepmom, but other mother. So, and then the pandemic hit. So those kinds of themes were really on my mind.
You know, I hear John Irving in what you're saying. I hear Philip Roth in what you're saying. Talk about, and no doubt there's other, they may or may not be real inspirations, but there's, and no doubt there's other authors who have been influential in your life. Regardless, what gets you high when you're writing?
Too much coffee, Mike.
Too much coffee? What about your writing gets you high?
Seriously. What gets me high is that state of immersion that is so precious that you're not aware of it when you're in it, because you're in it, baby. And so when I'm just excited by the characters, their stories, what's going to happen, and it's a flow state where 2 hours feels like a minute. So that's the high. And you can't really force it. It's like when, let's say, you're tossing and turning in bed and you can't sleep, and then you realize the next morning, oh, I fell asleep. I didn't realize, like, when I fell asleep. It's kind of like that. You can't force it. But when that happens, and you're just in it, it's just such a great feeling.
So what writer most inspires you? Is there a writer that is kind of the one that is a favorite or gives you the most inspiration for your own writing?
Well, it's hard for me, Mike, to choose just one. I've for a long time been inspired by the Bronte sisters, who have this extraordinary creativity even as children. They created these worlds and novels. Their brother had been given this set of toy soldiers, and they created all these like miniature books, which I actually went to Haworth, where they lived, and I saw these miniature books that they did as children. And I'm also really moved by the depth and the breadth of the worlds in the novels, particularly of Emily and Charlotte, you know, Wuthering Heights, Jane Eyre, Villette, because they lived in this tiny, tiny house in Haworth on the moors, completely isolated, and they had very little experience of the world, but their imaginations were incredible. And I've recently been inspired by the novelist Douglas Stewart, who is originally from Glasgow and lives in New York. And during the pandemic, I found, like many people, I was having trouble with concentration. I was having trouble reading, which was really a drag. And then I picked up his novel, Shuggie Bain, which is just amazing. He just transforms incredible loss and pain into this devastatingly beautiful story. It's probably the best novel that I've read in 10 years. And interestingly, my husband, he's a big reader. He also likes science fiction, which I don't really take to. So I said, you have to read this book. I want us to read the same book. And he really couldn't read it. It's very dark in a way. And the writing is gorgeous. It's about this gay boy in Glasgow, this really macho culture during the Thatcher era. And he's raised by his single mom, who's an alcoholic, so it sounds very dark, but I just adore this novel, so I'm inspired by him, Douglas Stewart. And then I'm inspired by the late African-American playwright August Wilson, and I keep this framed quote of his above my writing desk, which I know by heart, and I just find it really beautiful. He says, you have to confront the dark parts of yourself and work to banish them with illumination and forgiveness. Your willingness to wrestle with your demons will cause your angels to sing. Use your pain as fuel, as a reminder of your strength. And it goes on. But I think one thing that I've learned is that sometimes the topics that we shy away from, or we kind of cringe a little bit, that's where we have to go. I think that the obsessions and the difficult subjects of things that keep us up at night, that's going to yield a more compelling story. And sometimes it's hard to go to some of those places. So I said writing gives me joy, but there have been times when I've been writing about really difficult things, so it's been really painful too. But I think that the work is better. But other writers might feel differently, where they just have a lot of fun and, you know, humor is a great thing. You know, you can't force that. So those are some of the writers. There are lots of writers that I'm inspired by, but I find that at this point in my life, if a book doesn't compel me, I have no, you know, I will put it aside. Life is just too short to force myself through a book.
I remember a time in my life when I was hell-bent to finish a book, and I would do it, and you get to a certain point where you realize there's not enough time to read everything or even come close to reading everything. And why spend time with something that's not really speaking to you? Move on to something different. And not moving on because you're running away from a subject, because it might be confrontational, it might be painful, because those are times when maybe you should be forging ahead. You know, let me get back to the Douglas Stewart book. What's the title of that one again?
It's called Shuggie Bain, which is the name of the main character. Like, he pronounces it Shuggie, and he has a thick Scottish accent. I pronounce it Shuggie. So that's the boy. And it goes from when he's very little up until he's a teenager. And it's quite a book. I mean, people, as I said, you know, it's so interesting, you know, my husband had to put it aside. He left it somewhere. Fortunately, I got the hardback signed, because he found it just too dark. He just couldn't deal with it. He didn't want to read it.
That's very common.
C'est la vie.
Yeah, people who won't go to movies because they make them sad. To me, the arts, whether it's reading, going to an art exhibition, a fine art exhibition, or movies, the thing that I look for is experiencing my full range of emotions. It reminds us of our humanity.
Exactly.
I want that
Oh, for sure.
spectrum. I want that spectrum. And listening to sad music is one of the favorite things that I do. Dealing with...
What's your favorite sad music? What music do you like?
Well, there's a lot of Neil Young music that's sad. A song like Helpless,
Oh, yeah.
is very sad. And there are... boy, there's any... And also a lot of... I listen to a lot of instrumental music as well that's clearly... That's tearful. That sounds as if there's weeping or crying going on, and it's very beautiful stuff. But it repels certain people because they are not willing to entertain those emotions. They want to keep them at bay, and and we become a society, certainly in the United States, where there are a lot of people have turned to antidepressants, and antidepressants tend to take away a lot of emotion. The highs and the lows are gone. It's the good news is you don't get depressed. The bad news is you don't get all that exhilarated about anything or happy about anything. So that's an issue. It's just a sad part of the whole equation. And hopefully in the not too distant future, we'll be doing something much more meaningful than that. Something that's certainly a new generation of drugs or treatments of some kind that will get us past that. You also mentioned, the Bronte sisters. Have you ever had a character in any of your books like Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights?
I love the character of Heathcliff. I don't think so, not per se, but I do love that novel. It's a really interesting novel.
And a movie. I have an older sister who used to watch it every time it came on TV, and she would just be sobbing at the end of the movie.
Oh, gosh. The original one is so amazing with Laurence Olivier is the best version, because they've made other versions of it. But
that's the one. That's when she would watch
the original.
Talk about your writing regimen, because as we know, all of us who write know that there's tremendous persistence that's necessary, but there's also a lot of strategy involved in that. So talk about how you write. What is how often do you write? How much time do you put in per day? How do you approach it physically and strategically?
Sure. So I usually have a big cup of coffee in bed every day, and I kind of take my time getting up. I'm not a real morning person, despite the fact we're speaking in the morning. But I do my best writing in the morning. So when I say I'm not a morning person, I don't like to have to interact a lot in the morning if I can help it. Of course, I have to at times. But I have coffee in bed. Sometimes I'll start writing there. And then I segue to my office, which is my room of one's own, to quote Virginia Woolf, which is next door. I find it very stressful to have to write if I only have a little bit of time, because I just, as I talked about that immersion, it's hard for that to happen, or if it does happen, it'd be, really frustrating. So I try to work about 4 hours during the week from the time I get up, and then in the afternoon I'll do other things. I'll do my freelance paying work or, appointments if I can manage to make them at those times. And I find that I can put in more time when I'm revising, but when I find the rough draft stage really kind of difficult, and I need to put the critics sort of in the outhouse so I can just write. So when I'm actually drafting, what I usually do is I try to write about 3 to 5 pages each day. And I work during the week. And then on the weekend, if I want to work, fine, but I usually do other things. So the page, or I'll write down, I have these little 3x5, those post-its that have lines, and I always write down what I want to accomplish that day. I usually write the next day. I usually do it the night before. And
And then your mind goes to work on it during the night and in your dreams. Sometimes we can go to sleep with a problem on our mind, and then we wake up the next morning and there's a solution because the subconscious mind's been working on it.
Exactly. And sometimes I'll start like the next thing for the next day just so I'm not, so I can get into it more easily. But I do these little goals for myself, daily goals and monthly goals. And also when I'd hope to say finish a first draft, because if you don't do that, you can just fail to, just kind of slack off. So I definitely do have some structure to my writing.
Now, do you outline a book when you're working on it, or do you start with an idea and attempt to let it fill out organically?
Well, I write very freely at first, so I don't do an outline at first. This is different from my nonfiction writing because I do some nonfiction writing, and there I might do a little outline again on these like 3x5 little post-it lined pads. But for fiction, the first draft, I just want to have this real free flow of ideas. So I just write and write and write. I don't even look at it sometimes. It's all on the computer. And then I do an outline later as I kind of figure out the novel. So it's kind of weird. I don't lock myself into an outline in the beginning. I often know what the beginning and the end is, though, or where I think I'm going. So that's helpful.
Yeah,
But
precisely.
the free writing is really important to me, and it's hard for me too because I feel like, oh, I'm writing a bunch of crap here. It's terrible, blah, 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 that inner voice. But I just try to do it, get into it, and then I always find that there's really great stuff in there, and I have to go through that process. I've interviewed and met writers who write very differently, like Zadie Smith and certain Nicole Krauss, who I interviewed, where every sentence has to be perfect, and they go on to the next sentence and they do one draft. And that's not at all the way I work. Both Nicole Krauss, who's an amazing writer, and Zadie Smith, another amazing writer, that's how they write. So they're probably geniuses, but I can't work that way. I have to kind of go through a lot of different stages with my work.
Well, they might be geniuses, but they also may be editing as they go. I mean, Tom Robbins is a guy who writes a single draft, but he says he doesn't release a sentence until it has been written and rewritten until it's polished, and then he moves on from there. So he feels like the rewriting process is going on continuously in tandem with the writing process. Now, I don't write that way. I think it's very difficult to write that way, but it works for him. And I suspect other writers are also don't like to release a section of writing, or maybe even a sentence, until they've really bore down on it and feel like they've put a spit shine on it. So, to use a military term, spit shine. What's the best piece of
See,
writing
I can't.
advice you've received?
Well, it really goes back to that quote that I read you by August Wilson. Just not being afraid to confront difficult material. And another great piece of advice, I'm just thinking of it now. I had a teacher, Paula Fox, who's a writer, and she said, go to your desk no matter how you feel. That's good advice. And tenacity is so important in writing. And I hate it when I teach people and they want to know how to get fame and fortune, like before they've even written anything. So it's just, you really have to kind of go to your room no matter how you feel and see what happens. So that was great advice. And just sticking with it. I mean, that hasn't been so difficult for me because this is what I want to be doing. I'm not doing this for fame and fortune. Not that I would mind fame and fortune, but that's not my purpose. I think there are people who are always trying to second guess, like, what's going to be the next big topic, and they're always one step behind, because you have to write what's meaningful to you. I don't really agree with entirely write what you know, or, like, it's such a complex thing. I mean, I think you have to write what you're really interested in. Maybe some of it you know, maybe some of it you have to learn about. So that advice doesn't really work for me, to only write what I know, because that would really limit me as a writer.
I agree.
So those are some, yeah, you have to be able to write
what you want to know.
You know.
Make it an exploration. Write what you want to know. I think most writers have a lot of interest. Most writers have a lot of interest, and yet we are ignorant about a lot of the things we are interested in. And the developmental process is a learning process. So I think that's great advice. So
I'm gonna use that one with my students. I really like that. Write what you want to know, because a lot of times, isn't writing kind of a process of discovery? So that's a great piece of advice. We're trying to understand and learn something.
Yeah. I think there's a richness to that, because we all want to learn, and then to be able to transmute that onto a written page in a form that is meaningful to us and meaningful to readers that's a beautiful thing. It's the artistic process. Now, you mentioned you go to an office to write. You mentioned sitting in a chair. But you also mentioned, I think you're a fairly physical person in terms of taking walks, maybe hiking and so on. Do you get writing done while you're on the move as well?
Oh, very much. And that's really important to me, because I can't sit all day long. You know, I really need to move, and I get a lot of my ideas. I love swimming. I love water. It's my happy place. So I get a lot of ideas. Swimming in a pool is a little monotonous, but that's kind of a good thing. I just like the feeling of being in the water and riding my bike and hiking. So I really do a lot of thinking on the move, for sure. And I think people can get very tense at their desk and kind of blocked up, so that's very important to me, and I'm pretty active. You know, that's been a part of my life. My dad really emphasized that growing up, and my mom as well, so I've been active my whole life, and I love it. And it also gives you, you talked about the high of writing, well, you know, those endorphins of being physically active are just amazing. It's just a natural thing, and it's real.
Talk about creating characters, because you like reading about interesting characters. You like writing interesting characters. Talk about creating characters. What can you tell us about your approach to that?
Well, sometimes, you know, a character will be based partly on someone I know, or a composite, or imagination. Recently, our family rented a home for Christmas in the Eastern Townships, and the woman who rented the home kind of fascinated me, because the house was sort of like, it felt like the house was her lover. It was like this incredible house, like from the, I think it was, I don't know if it was from the 18th century, like this incredible old beautiful house. And she didn't want to leave, and so that got my character antenna buzzing. I thought, wow, that would make an interesting character for a story. But you have to get those layers in, so that's something I do. I take time to really go deeper, which is really, really important.
Then there's this whole effort with keeping a character consistent. In other words, later in the book, you're writing something about that character, that character is speaking, and it's kind of like, is this consistent with what I had developed earlier? That's always challenging, because on the one hand, you want the freedom to say what you have to say, or let that person say what they have to say. But if it's inconsistent, then the character's personality starts to look maybe a little neurotic or psychotic even.
Well, I think, there's consistency, but I think that people are really complicated, and that's why characters are interesting. They have a lot of different facets. But if you see something really inconsistent, everything in fiction is making it believable. Like, how did the character get there? In this current book, I have a character who we see, well, we see this character being born, then we see this character as a teenager, and then we see him as an older man. And so you have to kind of believe that that's the same character. And I think revision can help with that, when you realize that there might be an issue that, oh, would that character really say that or do that? That's, you know, you can work on that and make it more believable.
So what's behind the title of your latest work? Let's get to your book. And by the way, for your listeners, Amy Stans Brodoff joins us from Montreal, Canada. That's where she resides and works. The title, again, of her latest book is The Sleep of Apples. It's one of several books she's written. And if you look in the program notes, I've listed at least some of the others. So The Sleep of Apples, you're not the first one to use apples in a title, of course. The first one I had ever heard of is Comfort Me with Apples by Peter DeVries, which is a comedic novel. You've heard of that one?
No, I haven't. I wasn't aware of that. It's funny how the title came to me. As when my younger son was a teenager, he woke up one morning and he said to me, he was a kid who would fall asleep in different parts of the house, like just kind of very, very active, athletic. And he just like crash out. Sometimes we didn't know where he was, and he would be asleep in the basement or something. But he woke up as a teenager and he said, Mom, I slept the sleep of apples. And I thought he'd made it up, and I thought it was so beautiful and kind of mysterious. And then I found out that there's this gorgeous poem by Federico Garcia Lorca. And it's called, the poem is called Gacela of the Dark Death. And it's this beautiful poem that is really about life, sleep, death, eroticism, and immortality. And it just really grabbed me, and it fits very much with the title novella, which comes last in the book. And I like the fact that there's some mystery to it, and people will read the title and I think they'll become intrigued. Like, what is it? It also has the epigraph of the book, has the poem, so you see when you open the book that where the title comes from. But I'm pretty happy with that title.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with the title, that's for sure. It is intriguing. Now, the novel itself is set in Montreal, and Montreal's gritty and gentrifying St. Henri or Saint-Henri neighborhood. And what grabbed my interest, in addition to other elements of this, is that it's a linked collection of short stories. So the way I read that is that you basically created a series of short stories that are, there's continuity between them, and it reads as a novel. And one of the reasons I found that interesting to begin with, you can check me on that and whether or not I've actually characterized that properly. But one of the things that makes that interesting is that a lot of people look at a novel and they realize that it's just such a big undertaking. But with any big project of any kind, people will tell you, break it into pieces. And if you think in terms of, well, I can deal with a short story, but a novel is just so overwhelming. But if you treat the novel, you've outlined it or you know where you're going with it, and you break it into short stories, and you ensure that there's continuity between those stories so that there is a story that tracks, it can be much more manageable. Why did you approach it this way? Was it for that reason, or were there some other reasons involved?
Well, I think this book is kind of a hybrid, straddling the novel and the short story form. I think I just was working on these different stories, and I became really involved with the characters. And though they were all really different from one another, the neighborhood of Saint-Henri kind of pulled them together. And I'd read some, we talked earlier about who inspired me, and I read some wonderful books that were this genre that my book is. There's a writer called Joan Silber who always does this. Her book, Improvement, Secrets of Happiness, Ideas of Heaven, they're all in this form. And then there's, you know, Elizabeth Strout, who is a wonderful writer, also has a novel and stories. And There's another writer, David Zaloy, who was nominated for the Booker Prize. He has a couple of books. One is called All That Man Is. And another one that I reviewed that I just loved called Turbulence, which is all different airplane flights. And then you see how the people are connected. So it's a form that I've really enjoyed reading. I have another story collection that's not in this form. It's kind of joined thematically, like, but each story is kind of different. I knew I didn't want to write just a grab bag of stories that had no relationship, so it kind of developed organically that I was going to do linked stories for this. And it kind of has a real powerful impact because the reader sort of finds out these connections themselves and is a lot more active than in a novel where you might have more, you know, backstory and context. So I had a lot of fun writing this book.
Now, I see here in the notes that there's 9 interconnected narrators. I'd like you to talk about that a little bit. Are these 9 different people who are offering a different perspective on what's happening? I mean, I've seen books written in a manner that would say Amy's story, and the next chapter might be Michael's story. And it's one story, but of course, no two people see things the same way. Our interpretations are so different. I mean, you know what they say, it's 10% is what happens and 90% is how you react to it. And certainly people, the same event can happen with people and they come away with very different perspectives. So talk a little bit about the 9 interconnected narrators. That sounds like a lot of narrators.
Yeah, well, it begins and ends with the same character called Miri, and she becomes a psychiatrist. So she's actually the psychiatrist of a number of the characters. She takes care of some of them. And both the first story and the last story were kind of inspired by family secrets in my family. I found out that, well, I always wondered why there was such a big gap between my father and his younger sister, my Aunt Bobby. There's like an 11-year gap. And I found out, not from my father, but from someone else, that there had been another sister, a younger sister, and that my father had measles at around 5 years old, and his little sister caught it and died, and that his parents really blamed him. And my dad did become a doctor, and it was a kind of defining event of his life, really, and I didn't even know about it because he never talked about it. So that's kind of the inspiration for the first story. And so there's some cohesiveness in that we begin with Miri and we end with Miri. The first story, she finds out the secret about her dad. Again, it's a little bit transformed and different than, you know, real life. And each story, many of the characters narrate more than one story. And yeah, you do get different perspectives. A number of them are in the first person, some are in the third person. And just seeing how they fit together, I think, was so exciting. So it does end up being cohesive, I hope.
Well, that's a challenge. It's always a challenge, let alone with this particular model that you used. Now, in one of the stories, a person named Collier is a gender-fluid, non-binary teen. There's so much conversation about this sort of thing today. There's Rachel. She's a breast cancer survivor. And I understand you also, Amy, are a breast cancer survivor.
Yeah.
And also the mother of a transgender son and a gay son. Mm-hmm. So you're writing about an awful lot of what you know. Is this almost cathartic for you at the same time? You deal with mental, and we'll get to this in just a minute, but you deal with mental health issues a lot in this novel. Mm-hmm. But let's start with these characters that you created that are very much in the conversation today, the non-binary, non-fluid sort of thing. Obviously, breast cancer has been with us for a long time. Then the transgender son, the gay son. Elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, well, the characters are not literally based on anyone in my family, but starting with the mental health issue, the older brother that I talked about, I have two brothers, but the older one, who I was really close to growing up, so close, he developed schizophrenia as a teenager, and that was a real trauma for the whole family. And it's a devastating illness. I wish they would make more progress with treatment, but it used to be called dementia praecox. It tends to get worse, you know, as time goes on. So, and then I also have volunteered with schizophrenic people in New York. I'm from New York originally, at a place called Fountain House, which is this really humane clubhouse for people with schizophrenia who've been cut off from their families. They have a Thanksgiving dinner, and they do all kinds of wonderful activities. And I did creative writing with people there. You know, we wrote in the moment. And my husband taught some computer skills. We used to volunteer there when we lived in New York. So, and then there's other mental illness in the family. My husband's father had schizophrenia, and my husband's mother was a survivor of three concentration camps in the Holocaust. So she had what we now know is post-traumatic stress. So it's just an issue that's really close to my heart that I always write about. I was shocked with my brother. He was supposedly had an IQ in the genius bracket, but even teachers and doctors, when he was kind of becoming very ill, they weren't necessarily empathetic. And there's still so much stigma, and I think stigma comes from things that we're afraid of, we don't understand, and that's so painful, not only for the person suffering, but for the family. So that's an issue that comes into my work a lot. There's a story in this collection, the shortest story in the book, called Will the World Pause for Me? And it's from the point of view of a teenage girl who's an artist, who is just developing schizophrenia in her point of view. So that was a real act of imagination, empathy, and also experience, because I've been with schizophrenic people. So that's where that comes from. The character of Collier is gender fluid, and that's something that interests me. I mean, I really grew up with, like, the binary, you know, you're male or female, but a lot of people don't feel that that fits who they are. My younger son is a transgender man, so he's different than my character in a lot of ways. So that was, you know, an adaptation for my husband and I when our older son told us that he was gay when he was about 14. And then our younger son was always major tomboy, like a two and a three. He says, I'm a boy, I'm a he. So in one way, we weren't that surprised. But when he was in his, you know, late teens, early 20s, came out as transgender. And so we support them and adore both of them. But, of course, we had to adapt to those identities.
Of course. Now, you pull a lot from your own life in your writing, not that you're taking a real people and just going ahead and creating them in full cloth, but, you know, there's composite characters, there's affectations to existing characters and so on. You say that your work is not autofiction. Autofiction is very popular these days, and for anybody who's not familiar with that term, it's basically autobiographical fiction, a novel that reads like an autobiography. One of the really good ones that I recommend that I read recently is called Homeland Elegies. And I forget the author's name, but he's a...
Oh, I know who it, yeah.
Yes, he's an Islamic American and writes beautifully, and he really tells the story of his life. It's clearly a lot of it's autobiographical, but it reads beautifully. It's been a very successful book. But you're not writing autofiction. But at the same time, you're pulling from your own life. So talk about the distinction.
Well, yeah, autofiction is not something that attracts me for my own work at all, although I'm definitely interested in reading Homeland Elegies, and there have been other books that are autofiction that I've enjoyed. I would feel for me to with the mental health, mental illness, that it would be putting on a straitjacket. Like, I really like to be able to imagine, and I'm not really writing my life. Things are transformed and you know, changed, and I really love being able to imagine and to change things up. So autofiction, I guess, is just something that has never really appealed to me. And in the same way, I've never really been interested in writing a memoir. I have a number of essays that deal with events in my life. I have an essay about being the sibling of a schizophrenic brother. I have an essay about my relationship with my mom, which was very, very difficult. And they tend to be very short, these essays. And when something really compels me, I may write an essay like that. But I really love the depth and the breadth of a novel, and I can invent. So autofiction just doesn't appeal to me personally as a path that I want to take for my own work. So I certainly respect people who are doing it and doing it well.
You know, you also have spoken about the pervasiveness of mortality in this book, mm-hmm. And why death is the final taboo. Talk about that.
Well, I think that, you know, we don't like to think about it. We deal with it with kind of avoidance and terror, but we like to feel that, you know, life is eternal and we're immortal. And you feel that a lot when you're young. You don't think about death very much unless it's kind of darkened your door. But I think with COVID, everyone's become more aware of it. And as I said, I lost, you know, all my parents and dealt with sort of helping them through their deaths. My mother, I spent a lot of time with her before she died, even though we had a very difficult relationship. And she had lung cancer, so I knew that it wouldn't be long. And I visited and we talked. And it really comforts me now because I was able to kind of heal our relationship a bit. She was a difficult woman and kind of had a difficult mother herself. And then I was so close to my dad, you know, adore my dad. And he and my other mother kind of died, you know, one after the other kind of thing. And so, you know, death kind of was something I was really dealing with myself. And then the pandemic hit. But one of the stories, the novella, deals with sort of choreographing your own death, having a kind of death that you want to have rather than just protracting life through, you know, all these awful medical interventions. And my older son, who is now doing a residency in psychiatry at Columbia Presbyterian, he was telling me that he was working with some families who had terminally ill parents, and they just wanted to do everything, do anything, you know, even if their parents were vegetables, and even if it would be, you know, ridiculous, you know, not a pleasant, no benefit. So I became interested in this idea of, like, dying well, which was something that came up with the bubonic plague. People became interested in the so-called lost art of dying and making it more humane, where the dying person is sort of an actor in a play. I think we have to be aware that we're all going to die. We don't know when. And just making our life meaningful and, you know, it's a one-way road, really. So I just became interested in that, I guess, because that was really affecting me profoundly in my own life, but not writing about it literally.
Yeah, death is, you know, kind of the elephant in the room, but it's an invisible elephant, I should say, because we choose not to look at it. We choose not to talk about it. It's awfully confrontational. But at the same time, when we focus on death and that we have X amount of time, which nobody knows how much time they really have, it can also be motivating. to get moving on things, because ultimately, when the time comes, we want to be able to say that we did something meaningful, or we did something, we did something that we wanted to accomplish during that period of time. You know the famous quote about of all the words of heaven, I'm misquoting, but all the words of heaven and earth, the saddest of all is what might have been. And a lot of people spend their whole lives avoiding something. And sometimes when we really focus on death and know that it could come at any time, let's get moving. Let's get things done, and let's have a healthy attitude towards death, and go from there. Amy, this has been a very interesting conversation. You're a very thoughtful person, and dealing with some of these subjects, death, transgender, the gay lifestyle or the gay realization, all of these different topics, the collected or linked short stories. You obviously put a lot of thought into what you do. I love the fact that at such an early age, you knew you wanted to be a writer. It certainly sounds like a calling, and you approach it with it sounds like a lot of strategy and a lot of commitment. So the latest of your novels is The Sleep of Apples. Again, Amy Sands Brodoff has been our guest. Amy, thank you very much for taking the time and giving us again a thoughtful assessment of writing and the particular book you have just written.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been really fun to chat.